Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast trying to spread the proceeds of growth. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Now, this week, we are discussing the IPPR Commission on Economic Justice. They've spent a couple of years looking at the UK's economic problems and they've come up with a 10-point plan. So fasten your safety belts. Steve, it was quite sobering reading, looking through the problems as set out with the UK economy, and we've kind of hinted and talked about a few of them on the podcast, but it was quite stark to kind of, I suppose, get them all set out in a row. First one it talks about is inequality. That's not only between the regions, so the UK is the most unequal country in Europe in terms of the disparity of wealth between the poorest and wealthiest regions, but also 44% of wealth in Britain is owned by the top richest 10% of people. Talks about generational inequality because younger people are missing out on the housing market because of increased property prices. But it also talks about, in terms of the income growth we've seen over the past 30 years, only 10% of that income growth has gone to the bottom half of the population. 40% of that has gone to the richest 10%.
It is very stark reading. To be quite honest with you, it does outline quite vividly the issues that the British economy has and British society has with inequality. It does separate out the kind of like the regional disparities versus like the, you know, I suppose the class disparities would be the other way, mm-hmm. would be the other side of it that they look at. I don't think they use that kind of terminology. What's interesting is that those things tend to go hand in hand. An awful lot of the regional disparities are coming about as a result of that overall inequality, because the areas where which are economically poorer are also the areas where people just don't have as many good jobs to go to, and they're not as high paying because they're all in London. The two kind of inequalities of kind of economics that they focus on are very much linked. It's good to see that kind of put together in a way that, to be honest, I don't often think is done.
Yeah, and in fact, I think a lot of the other problems that we'll talk about are folded into the inequality problem. One of the things it talks about is that insecure work. So we've got 1 million people who are working on 0 hours contracts. 15% of the workforce is now self-employed. And there's a lot of working poverty as well. So we've talked about a lot of the food bank users of food banks are often working poor. It's not benefit scroungers as the tabloids might like to try and paint it as. It talks about the fact that growth is unbalanced. So you kind of hinted at that just now. The fact that Britain's economy depends too much on consumption, it's too much reliance on increased house prices, and also a reliance on consumer debt as well.
Yeah, and on that, what's quite interesting there is almost the difference between the what the IPPR are saying in this report, or commission rather, versus what an awful lot of the general mainstream discussion on the state of the economy is. So, you know, they're talking about it's an over-reliance on debt, it's too reliant on consumption. The general discussion that you will find in the Red Tops, as an example, is more along the lines of, isn't it a shame that we don't make things anymore? It's very much kind of a view of the economy which is based in the 1970s with manufacturing and things like that, viewing that as the problem rather than the actual problem, which is everything's fueled by debt.
That's interesting, because one of the things that struck me from the report is that one of the things it mentions as a problem is not only a lack of investment, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, but also trade deficits. So I remember doing A-level economics, which, now I come to think of it, was before the crash, which means it's a long time ago. This is in the height of the new Labour years. And
showing your age there, mate.
I know. It talks about how Britain has got the largest trade deficit of the G7 nations. And I remember being taught A-level economics. What my economics teacher said about the balance of payments was, well, it used to be a big problem, but it doesn't seem to matter anymore.
But I think, to be quite honest, one of the issues you've got with the general kind of like view of, and I think this goes for the modern economy across a lot of different nations, not just the UK, is that we seem to have it into our head that if you make something, it has to be something very, very physical. So it has to be a widget, it has to be a car, it has to be an iPhone or something like that. What we do in this country and across a lot of Western countries now, actually, is we do make stuff. It's just we make websites, we make computer games, we make films, books, literature. And those are all things, for instance, that Britain is actually very, very good at. But those things don't get treated as manufacturing. They don't get treated as part of goods that are part of the deficit. They get treated as services. And that is a core kind of failure to understand the modern economy, I think.
But I suppose part of that reliance on services probably leads to this regional imbalance we've talked about. And also, I think, a lack of retraining. So a lot of those manufacturing jobs were lost, and those miners were not retrained as coders.
No, 100%. There is, to be honest, the biggest flaw that Tony Blair, John Major and Maggie Thatcher made was not investing in the people who ended up losing their jobs or had lost their jobs throughout various the various closures that occurred under their premierships. That is what it forms this deep suit, the deep rooted inequality in a lot of these areas, as you say. But ultimately, economies change, and there's nothing you can do about that. Technology progresses, and what governments needed to do and abjectly failed to do is help people adapt and help people evolve into the newer economy.
And the report does have some interesting solutions to that. The report does say that this has been a problem for kind of 30, 40 years, that these problems haven't been addressed, and that has led to, it looks like the 2010s are going to be the weakest decade for earning growth in 200 years. So well done for us as millennials who entered the labour market at those times.
It's a wonderful time to be alive.
Although I suppose we didn't have to fight Napoleon. So, you know, given
swings
take,
and really, roundabouts. Cholera, not a problem for us.
Leaving Europe maybe in a slightly different sense. It probably is a bit of an intellectual failing on my part. I've never really put these things together. But it mentions, one of the things it says is essentially that Britain has low productivity, essentially because of the flexible labour market. Because of that insecure labour, because of those zero-hours contracts, firms don't really have the incentive to invest in their workers. And I've never really put those two things together before.
Yeah, and again, that the regional aspect of that plays into the property market area as well. Because obviously, where are all the good jobs? They're either in cities or in London or places like that. And where are all the more expensive housing? Where is it more expensive to rent? Well, it's London. It's in the cities. And as a result of that, you end up in a situation where people can't necessarily afford to move to where the good jobs are, which then means that productivity takes a further hit, and they end up stuck in smaller areas and smaller towns, which they're not able to necessarily get out of, and so you just end up trapped in this cycle.
Indeed, and the report it's got at its heart a very kind of moral argument, and it argues for a paradigm shift similar to that of the Attlee or Thatcher governments. But what I thought was interesting is kind of two different things. One of them is it's arguing for this huge paradigm shift. And that paradigm shift, I think, essentially is a shift in how we talk about the economy and how we conceptualise the economy. So it's written from a very socialistic, a very centre-left point of view. Its view is that better economies are those that are more equal. It's where growth is more inclusive. It's where workers have greater bargaining power. It's one that's environmentally sustainable. It's a very, very lefty model. It's not the kind of thing that, you know, said under New Labour. It is very much kind of, to caricature it, kind of Jeremy Corbyn, Bernie Sanders. It's that we would have called it almost far left a few years ago before we've kind of had the...
Yeah, but now it seems just very much to be part of the, you know, roughly where a lot of political discourse and debate is. And yeah, you're absolutely right. It very much is leaning more towards what I suppose is closer to that Scandinavian model in a lot of ways. And I think the fact that they point out the need for this far-reaching reform is probably actually the key point here, and we'll probably in the next... Once we get through Brexit. At least get out. Yeah.
2030.
Yeah, probably. You know, the next big debate in the UK is probably going to be on that issue. What sort of economy do we want to be? Because there are two ways you can reform the British economy to, in, you know, we will have our preference here, obviously, and I think we'd very much like to see something more akin to what's outlined in this IPPR report. But the alternative view for that, and you can start to see this happening a little bit on the right, is adopting more of that kind of capitalist East Asian free market economy style of doing things. South Korea, Singapore, those kinds of places, which are very rapidly developing countries, are doing very well for themselves economically, but in a lot of ways, that's not necessarily filtering down to your average Joe on the street.
Mm.
Those two poles of this debate, I think, are going to be where we end up kind of exchanging views. A lot of the way, it's basically going to be, do we want to be Norway or Scandinavian? Do we want to be Singapore? And I think this is quite a good first foray into that debate here from the IPPR.
Because at the moment, it feels like the debate is between, do we become North Korea, Venezuela, or Mad Max?
Yeah.
Which isn't very helpful. But what I think is interesting is, although that paradigm shift is very socialist, the policies themselves, and this kind of fits in with what you've been talking about, the policies themselves, in terms of the ones that jumped out when I was reading their kind of plan, are kind of a mixture of all political parties, really. So it's got Labour policies in there. So it talks about, say, a national investment bank, which is similar to something John McDonnell's talked about. It talks about an idea of a good job standard that you could use to decide which firms you contract out public services to. And that's very similar to when we talked about Carillion and the future of outsourcing under a Labour government. John Trickett has made some very similar noises in terms of making sure you contract out to decent firms rather than just Carillion. It talks about, one of the policies it talks about is a kind of personal training credits. So the idea that you get a kind of personalised fund that you workers can pay to receive training, which I'm sure is pretty similar to an idea that Steve Hilton put in his book, More Human, I think it's called. You've also got some Tory policies in there. So one of the things in there is that firms should start monitoring an ethnic pay gap, which in the past month or so, Theresa May has come out and said could be Tory policy. Workers on boards is a policy which is just ubiquitous now because I think it was Ed Miliband and now it's Theresa May. Abolishing the cap on borrowing for councils so they can build houses.
That was announced at Tory conference.
Which is stolen from Jeremy Corbyn. You've also got a land reform tax in there, which I think is quite a Lib Dem idea. It always seems to be one that's kind of talked about in Lib Dem circles.
Yeah, the Lib Dems are big on their land value taxation reform. If you talk to proponents of it in the Lib Dems, it's the solution to everything.
Is the Lib Dems what universal basic income is?
Yes.
To a certain amount on the left, I see.
Yeah, occasionally those groups of people intertwine and the way to fund universal basic income is through a land value tax. And I'm not even joking.
And the serpent eats its own tail.
Yeah.
A theme of this podcast has been there could definitely be, like, May's brand of conservatism, that Erdington conservatism that old friend of the podcast and nemesis Nick Timothy was kind of inching towards. A lot of what May's talking about in terms of trying to address the deep-seated inequalities, in terms of workers on boards, in terms of more responsible capitalism, it's all there. It's just, as you say, there's a national emergency going on and no one's talking it. Well, I mean, Labour's talking about it. And John McDonnell, Jeremy Corbyn are going on about it with some decent policies, a lot of which I can see them using from this report. But the government is nowhere at the moment.
Yeah, which is in many ways quite a shame because, as you say, a lot of the noises were there for all we mock Nick Timothy for being terrible at his job, which, generally speaking, he was and still is. The reality is he was tapping into something there, I think. And there is a strain of conservatism that should be replenished, which is not all about free markets and not all about the Gordon Gekko greed is good style approach, which seems to have become the defining feature in a lot of ways of modern conservatism. You know, this sort of stuff, as you say, some of these things can and do fit into the conservative philosophy, and they should be championing them, not just because they're the right thing to do, but because they'd be electorally popular and actually helpful for people and would help overcome a lot of their image problems.
Yeah, and I wonder if a reason for that is essentially the decline of the Tory wets that kind of happened under Thatcher in the 80s. It used to be that a lot of kind of public sector workers like doctors, teachers, generally, you would assume they would be conservative.
Because of how much they earned in comparison to other people, yeah.
And in social class, you know, it's white-collar jobs rather than working jobs. And that's completely shifted the other way.
Yep.
And that's happened over the past 30 or 40 years. And since then, and especially the new generation of Tory MPs is essentially Thatcherism on steroids, trying to demolish the single market, which was Margaret Thatcher's signature creation on the European level.
Yeah.
And
but let's not talk about Brexit again.
So what I thought was interesting in terms of the policies, what I thought were the most interesting ones is how to try and counteract the gig economy. Because as someone who's worked on a 0 hours contract, it's something that not only do you know that it's insecure work and leads to a whole lot of problems down the line in terms of insecure pay, in terms of insecure mental health, in terms of not knowing how much money you're going to come in. It's also really hard to try and ban those contracts, which I think was Labour policy under Ed Miliband, and we kind of carried that on in the manifesto last year. Jeremy Corbyn's talked about us trying to do now in terms of trying to fireproof the manifesto and make our ideas more practical. I think that the IPPR has got some really good ideas of how you can do that with the gig economy, because their idea is essentially you raise the national living wage to the real living wage based in London. And the way that you can try and fund that and make it easier for business to adjust is to temporarily reduce national insurance contributions for businesses. And on top of that national living wage, which would be $8.75 an hour currently, you'd have a 20% higher minimum wage, which applies to 0 hours contracts. And that self-employed people would then get other work-related benefits, which would make sense. And also, if you're on the gig economy, you would be auto-enrolled into a trade union. And one of the other things that the IPPR starts talking about is really trying to boost up trade union membership, which I think is kind of is interesting and probably necessary when we're talking about the gig economy.
Yeah, I mean, there is a definite theme throughout this report that says trade unionism is something that needs to be brought back to the forefront of modern working life, because it's through trade unions that you can actually ensure that people have the collective power to improve their working conditions, improve their wages, all the stuff that, you know, trade unions are supposed to do. What's interesting, though, is that there's a bit of a dichotomy in some ways between what this report is talking about in terms of trade unions and the importance they play, and what they say in other bits where they talk about, in effect, kind of devolving kind of economic power away from monopolies, away from big businesses, towards smaller companies that are maybe a bit more regional and so on and so forth. Both of those things, generally speaking, are things I am in favour of. So I'm not coming at this from a negative angle. But they are, in some ways, actually kind of counterproductive against each other. Because unions work at their best where people are mass employed by a single employer. That's why they were so effective in the olden days. Because, you know, when everybody was employed by at the Longbridge car manufacturing plant, you know, it was very easy for you to just get in at that one big employer, make some changes there, and for those changes to cascade out, whether that be directly just for the workers there, but also because once those changes have been brought in and the lot of those workers has improved, everybody wants to get a job at Longbridge. Therefore, you know, other employers are forced to react to that and improve working conditions themselves to keep a hold of their staff. But that's easiest done when there's bigger, larger sets of employers. And yet what bits of this report are talking about are trying to move power away from bigger employers towards smaller, maybe regional players and things like that, which are going to be very difficult for trade unions to actually get a foothold into. Things like auto-enrollment could be widened out from just the gig economy into other areas, potentially as a way to achieve this. But ultimately, trade unionism only works if you've got people who are willing to actually do the organising. So you need a shop steward, you need an actual rep in every office to actually make it work. And given how a lot of smaller businesses are, you're going to struggle to find people that are actually prepared to do that sort of stuff. As a result of that, when you're reliant on lots of smaller businesses, it means that the unions are going to have a tougher time actually making the inroads that they need. So it's one challenge that I don't quite think the report has got an answer for just yet. But it doesn't mean it's wrong, but it's just there's another layer to all of this that still needs work.
So I would come at it a slightly different way. I think if we go back to the 70s, people worked at Longbridge because they lived near Longbridge and they walked in at 16, went out 4 years later with a clock. And I think if you... It's a very different labour market now. It's more flexible. There are not jobs for life in the same way. In terms of enforcing agreements in the 70s, actually, one of the reasons I think it was difficult to strike pay bargains with unions in the 70s is because essentially the unions were too diffuse. So you had your shop steward at Longbridge, you had your shop steward in Dudley, wherever it is all the way down the line. And that means when the union leaders went into beer and sandwiches at number 10 or whatever it was, what happened was the union leaders would make their agreement, fine, but they wouldn't be able to enforce that necessarily at the individual factories where the shop steward is negotiating, because those big union leaders don't necessarily have that power. Actually, I think what might happen if you have a kind of auto-enrollment is you almost return back to that kind of that idea where you've got smaller factories with other unions and where members are part of a union who are able to get that pay bargaining. And that, I think, could be really useful. I think the point about are you going to find people to serve as shop stewards, I think, is a really valid one. I think one of the things it doesn't mention, which maybe it could, is one of the things that right-wing blogs and people like Guido Fawkes have been trying to chip away at is union staff working full-time on union activity. And I think that is something that is important and needs to be preserved, precisely for the reason you're saying, is because you need people who've got the time and expertise to do that kind of thing. But I think why unions are important is because it is about, it's not even just having a shop steward there, it's about knowing that you've got someone who can back up your rights. You've got, even if, say, you don't have an active NUT rep, say, at your, or any U rep at your school, you know you've got a phone number you can go to and say, my employee's doing this, is this right? How long should I have for a break? What kind of health and safety regulations have we got? Just knowing there's someone out there who has got your back in terms of workplace rights, breaks, all that kind of thing, I think is really kind of important.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you on that at all. All of those things are definitely important. And, you know, having that single point of contact in some form is absolutely vital for that. But I think one of the areas you do end up in, and again, this is, in some ways, this is one of the areas where I don't necessarily think that the current trade union movement is particularly representative of the modern workplace, is that, as you say, over time, all of the different unions have kind of merged into one. Now, so you basically end up with, in effect, Unison and Unite for most things. Other than very, very specific things, mm-hmm. very specific things like transport workers.
I think Usdaw as well.
But there's a few others. But other than very specific ones, you know, most people are covered by one or two big unions, and that's it. The issue is for me, and you know, I could be very wrong with this. I'm not a member of a union, but one of the reasons I'm not a member of a union,
splitter,
I know, is because I've yet to see a union that actually talks about the things that I do for a living. Like, I went around and I actually looked it up, what union I should in theory be a member of, as working basically as a digital marketer who helps create copy and bits and pieces like that.
Was it the Digital Marketers Guild?
No, it was not. Mm. It was the NUJ, National Union of Journalists. There is a logic there. I can get it. I can see it. But it's not front of mind as somewhere I would look to go. I had to really dig around to see to try and find out which one was would have been the most suitable for me, given my role. But that kind of conglomeration means that there are an awful lot of types of jobs which don't easily fit into a lot of the unions, which they're covered. but people aren't going to be thinking about them. And if people aren't thinking about the unions in that way, then are the unions thinking about them in that way? If I'm a developer, who the hell do I go to? Are they even going to understand what the difficulties of being a developer are in the 21st century? You know, God only knows. And that's something that the unions need to overcome in some way if they actually want to be relevant. Obviously, that's not necessarily a kind of a policy that the IPPR can delve into, but it is a facet of this discussion which it's worth talking about, because ultimately, if we want to see a society where, you know, we're seeing better working conditions, where we're seeing better wages coming through the use of collective bargaining or whatever, the unions have to be an integral part of that. But they are not necessarily structured to do so at the moment.
I think the IPPR report is a start. The fact that it's trying to talk about, say, a trialing auto-enrolment into the gig economy, yep, for trade unions, talking about a kind of innovation fund to help unions to use digital technology to recruit and organise, which might kind of satisfy one of your quibbles, not yeah, quite the right word, but about shop stewards, is if you can have a Skype interview with another online marketer who's a shop steward somewhere else, that might kind of help.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So the technology stuff in here is pretty good as solutions go, but it's...
And just stuff in terms of like a right to access for trade unions, it's trying to, I think, account for the fact that whether because maybe it's just easier to recruit in public sector unions, and I think the unions maybe rested on their laurels a bit, or because they've had 30, 40 years of a kind of attacks and their rights being kind of shaved away, it's been really hard. And also because of the changing nature of the workplace, it's been really hard for them to get into these new industries. And essentially, I mean, it's not quite base camp at Everest for a lot of this, but it's not too far off for a lot of these kind of this new... gig economy. It certainly is probably base camp at Everest if you're looking at Uber, or if we say looking at workers in McDonald's
or who Deliveroo came out on strike,
and Wetherspoons and McDonald's who went on strike earlier as well. If we do have a Corbyn Labour government and with a kind of McDonald economic policy, I think one of the things they would try and do is put together that union movement and increasing the role that unions have in the economy. And this could be a productive way of doing it, I think.
Quite possibly, yes.
That's it for this week. I'm sure we'll probably talk about the more specific proposals the IPPR report has for other sectors in other episodes. But for now, if you want to hear more of our podcasts, you can find them on iTunes or Acast, wherever you subscribe. We have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com, and our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. My Twitter handle is @paperbackrioter.
And mine is @acousticradical.
James Crown designed our logo, and Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. Happy plotting, everyone.